Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
I'm Matt.
And today, we're answering your listener questions.
That's right, buddy. Today is an Ask How to Money episode. Every other Monday, we take listener questions here on the show. Listeners send in those voice memos. We love hearing your voice, and we love sharing your voice with our other listeners because we want to answer your questions. We've got five great ones this episode, including an investing question from a teenager. We've got a listener who is wanting to switch banks, but she wants to know what she should know. She wants to know what she should consider before
she
does
that. How do I do it the right way?
And we've got someone who has some self-employed life considerations to keep in mind before she makes the switch. We're going to answer those questions plus a couple others during this episode.
Sounds good. Before we get to that, we have, like you said, five good questions to get to.
You got a good frugal or cheap for me?
Well, not a frugal or cheap, okay. But I just want to quickly mention and a reminder to other people. This is something I just did myself, and now I'm like, I want to share this with our listeners because this is something they can do.
Better be good.
it's not going to blow your socks off, but I did order a Nest thermostat.
Oh, nice.
Not on Amazon, but from our electric company.
Even better.
Georgia Power. Because here's the deal.
Because,
on their website, you get a straight up 50% discount for getting the thermostat
like 50
from them.
To 75%, because I get the emails
from 75
from Georgia Power.
If you only got 50.
Oh, really?
Okay. No, I feel like a loser.
Maybe it's 75 off of like some of the square thermostats.
Yeah, I guess they have other things they sell now in their online store.
Yeah, they've got some other ones on there as well that you get rebates on. So it doesn't surprise me that maybe the less popular thermostats are having to offer more of a discount, because those Nest thermostats are awesome. We've got two of them. We've got one upstairs or on the main level. Yes, exactly. I love the round look to them because they look like the old school thermostat, like the old Honeywell where you like move the dial, you know what I'm talking about? It's like a an old watch face. I like that look lot as well.
Not only are they attractive, but having a newer thermostat can save you money, especially one like a Nest, because of the way it kind of learns your habits and will it'll like kick on the heat or the AC accordingly. And so, yeah, I'm excited to install this one and to get a half price. And
that's a great deal.
To get a half price, but to know that having this new thermostat is, in all likelihood, going to cut down on my electricity bills. So it's one of those things where I think it's a frugal move, especially if you're getting that thermostat at a discount.
This isn't a frugal or cheap. This is just like
just frugal.
I bought this thing and it is going to save me money.
Well, and I wanted to mention one other thing is that on Georgia Power's website, there are other discounts that can be had on other things you might do to your home.
Other incentives that they've got there for you.
Yeah, like back in the day when I put new insulation in the attic, and that was a DIY move that my buddy Jay and I did together. He kindly did it free of charge. And then Georgia Power, I believe 50% of the amount of money I spent on that project, they covered it. And so, those are the kind of things where your home is becoming more energy efficient. You're going to lower your bills. And at the same time, you might get your power provider to pay for a portion of that upgrade.
Definitely. Yeah. So look into your local power provider and see if there are some different incentives there. I know one of the rebates that they offered for a while, I think they actually got rid of it, but they would take any working fridge off your hands for like $30-$40, that sort of thing. So basically, if you knew you had a fridge that nobody is going to want to buy because it was either so rusted or dented, just busted up, which oftentimes happens with rental properties sometimes, they will come and say, hey, like no matter what, you're going to get $30 or $40 for it, which was always really nice. But I wanted to mention too, because the Nest thermostats, one of the, like you're talking about how it learns, you know, it's like got the learning aspect of it. At first, I was annoyed by that because I have a schedule programmed in. I pull up the app on my phone. You can easily copy days, paste that same schedule to multiple days, that whole thing. And like once or twice a year, it kicks back into like the learning phase and it starts making tweaks. And at first, like I mentioned, I was totally annoyed, except for the fact that it pushes you.
Like, it knows you better than you know yourself.
It encourages you to save energy, because that's the whole point behind the Nest thermostats, is so that you use less energy. And initially I was about to pull up the app and I was going to erase all of the changes that it had made. But then I thought, wait a minute, you know, like we've been keeping it at 64 at night. Maybe we can handle 63 degrees. The girls are, you know, they're nice and cozy. They're nice and warm under their blankets. And so that was actually a change that I allowed. And I don't know how much that 1 degree is saving me, but it's saving me something.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and so, yeah, like you said, it knows me better than I know myself.
Yeah, I'm excited to put it in and kind of see like what sort of changes it makes in my life. Because like you, I like to think of myself as maybe like overly into the thermostat settings. And so maybe this will take my mind off and I'll start doing some of that stuff for me.
It's like a little personal trainer for you.
Yes, exactly. But all right, Matt, let's mention the beer we're having on this episode. This one is called Really Green Street. It's by Trillium and Other Half. Literally, I can't think of two better breweries to make a collaboration
two
beer.
Two of our favorite breweries have teamed together. And yeah, this one was sent to us by Allie. I'm actually a little sad. This is the last of the Trillium beers that she sent our way. So, Allie, thank you again for the delicious beers, and we'll look forward to sharing our thoughts on this one at the end of the episode.
No doubt. All right, let's get on to the listener questions. And if you have a question and you want to submit one to Matt and I to take on an upcoming episode, well, just go to howtomoney.com/ask, and you can see the simple instructions for how to submit a voice memo of your question, and hopefully we can take it on the next Ask HTM episode. But this first question does come from a teenager in California.
Hi, Matt and Joel. My name is Arjun Mohan. I'm from Tracy, California, a small city, super small. It's basically about train station. I'm a teenager, and I am not financially independent. So here's my question. I am wondering how much I should contribute to my Roth IRA. I just recently scored a part-time job in the Mathnasium of Tracy. I don't know if it's my favorite place to work, but it's definitely a place to work. And I will be getting a pretty good chunk of money, not enough to hit the cap for my IRA. So here's where my question comes in. Let's say I am making 5 to 5.5 grand a year, and I do plan on putting 100% of it into my IRA. Is that a good idea? Just keep in mind, I am still a teenager. I still have teenage needs like going outside and eating, fashion, stuff like that, you know, stuff that I am into and I think I would enjoy having. So I don't know where and to what level I should contribute to my Roth IRA. My mom recommends that I contribute all of it to my IRA. And I am not really sure if that's the best decision for me, if that'll make me happy even, since I am going to grind through this job. It's definitely going to be a hard job. So yeah, hoping for your guys' opinion on this. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer my question. Bye.
Joel, man, we've got a small town young dude here who is already focused on growing his money, building wealth. I love that we've got this question specifically from a teenager. And Arjun, congrats too on scoring that job. I'm happy for you. But the reason that we are pumped that you are asking this question is because essentially, like, this is a timeless question that you will have to continually revisit and wrestle with for the rest of your life.
Yeah, we can't like settle it one and done here. Like,
no.
These are the kind of
yes.
things. Like,
this is the
core. Do I save more, invest more, or do I live life now? It's
yes. Yeah. No, finding that balance, like, that is literally at the core of what we talk about here on the show. Like, all the details, all the specifics, all the mechanics, those are just like kind of small details. But truly what is at the core is finding this balance between living life now and living life into the future. And so the fact that you're even asking this question already, this gives you a huge leg up on your peers. And, you know, your ability to delay that gratification is only going to grow stronger the more that you flex that muscle.
I agree. Yeah, I think I'm glad that Arjun is asking this question. Like, do I invest all of my money right now and forego some of those things that I actually want to do right now? And that's a deep question. We'll talk about that. But let's talk about compound interest first, Arjun, because yeah, you asked if it's a good idea to put every single dollar that you're making directly into a Roth IRA. And let's talk about the money side of it. From a purely financial perspective, yes, this is a fantastic move, especially given your age. Like, every dollar you invest now is going to grow in a big way, and that's because of what's known as compounding returns. This phenomena is when the money that you earn via those investments begins to earn money itself. And over the time, it's kind of like a snowball going downhill, right? And it just gathers steam, it gets bigger, and it started small, maybe at the very top of the hill. But once it's at the bottom, it's this enormous thing that's like immovable. And yeah, it's why Albert Einstein called it the eighth wonder of the world. And he said, he who understands it, earns it. He who doesn't, pays for it. And so, yeah, if you've been listening to this podcast and you're looking to invest some of your hard-earned dollars in a Roth IRA, I'm sure you know this already. But let's bust out some of the numbers for you, Matt. You're our resident numbers guy.
I do like crunching the numbers.
I like to go with the gut. You like to go with the numbers. So, yeah. Why don't you bust
give me that empirical data? And first of all, Arjun, I'll say, yes, your mom was right. This is the wisest move for you, financially speaking, but there's also a lot of other things that we're going to discuss here. But yeah, let's talk about the numbers. Let's say that there is a 16-year-old who starts...
Some 16-year-old in California.
Perhaps. Although he didn't say his age, did he?
Yeah, I think... maybe he didn't. But he's a teenager, so I bet he's like 15 or 16.
But let's say there's a 16-year-old who starts to max out their retirement account now, and they do that for the next 10 years until they are 26. So that means that you would have contributed a total of $60,000 of your own dollars to retirement. Congrats, because that is an entire decade of really hard work. And then assuming that you are earning just, let's say, a conservative 7% in that account, you'd see that total balance almost hit $83,000. So that's a gain of about $23,000, not too shabby. But now, at the age of 26, let's pretend that you stop contributing to your Roth completely, but then you continue to let that $83,000 grow for the next 40 years. By the time that you are 66 years old, that total balance will have exploded and will now be worth $1.2 million, all because you decided to max out your Roth IRA for your first 10 years of your career, I guess.
Of your investing career.
Yeah. And so that is a gain of over $1.1 million provided solely from compounding returns.
Yeah,
so,
you put in 60 G's and now you've got 1.2 million? That's impressive.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Well, I mean, the initial 60, that was based on your hard work. But then that additional $1.1 million was work that your money was doing. Yep. Like, that was the ability of your money to work harder than you would have been able to.
Okay, so Matt, I'm glad you shared the numbers. They're astounding. Like, they do.
Yeah.
That's what they're meant to do. And hopefully that just hearing those numbers is encouraging for anybody who's young to be investing more of their dollars.
And
now,
we even kept it at the conservative 7%.
That's right.
I was tempted to ratchet it up to 10 or even 12 because that's what the S&P 500 has seen over the past 40 years. It has seen 12%.
So, yeah, I think if you could even run those numbers at 9 or 10%, let's say, and it'd be even a whole lot bigger than that, Arjun. But, it makes you think twice, even about something, a small purchase maybe, that you might do. Like going out to get Taco Bell with some friends, where even that $4 or $5 decision, you're like, man, think about what that $5 is going to do for me over the next 30, 40 years. And it makes you think twice. Mm-hmm. But we're also all about balance on the show. And you don't want to get in the habit of foregoing all of the wants that you have in your life in order to just shovel money away for your future. We would say don't forgo your, as you put it, your teenager needs, because all work and no play makes Arjun a dull kid, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's really hard to stick with a difficult job or that investing strategy if you don't allow yourself to at least enjoy some of the fruits of your labor now. But how you balance that, that's kind of tricky.
That's right. And, you know, one thing I did want to bring up, Arjun, it sounds like your parents are strongly encouraging you to save every dollar that you're currently making. And I totally get that. You know, they probably wish that they had started investing as early as you are looking to do.
Don't we all?
Yeah. I mean, most of us do wish we would have started sooner. But one thing that you might want to ask is if they would be willing to match your contributions. And so let's say that you make $5,000 in a given year. Would your mom be willing to contribute $2,500 to your Roth if you invest half of your earnings? If so, that would be awesome. But I also get that they may not be in the financial position to do so. But if they could, this is a route that we would love to see just parents in general. Anybody out there who's listening, we would love to see you take because they're helping their kiddo invest more of their earnings while still allowing them to use some of that money to go towards having some fun.
Yeah, still being able to hit up the Taco Bell every once in a while or go see a movie or, you know, whatever it is, live esports events. I don't know. That's
sure
what kids are into. So,
and the thing is, too, I love this because this mirrors the real world.
Yeah.
You know, like this isn't a handout. This is what employers do with a 401k. They match money that you contribute yourself.
Just so, to a much bigger degree.
Totally. Well, yeah, I mean, some employers actually match 100%, not all of them.
That's true.
But the ability for your parents to do that, it is not unrealistic for them. It's not a handout, is what I'm pointing out.
And parents that can afford to do that, they're incentivizing their kids in the right way, and they're helping their child or, you know, the young man or woman to get in the habit of doing the right thing simultaneously while starting to build wealth really, really young. It's super exciting to see your money double instantly, and then, you know, that money, like Matt said, is going to increase by a whole lot more than that over the years. And yeah, just remember, you can't contribute more in total than your earned income, Arjun. And so, yeah, man, it's a great thing. You're earning this money. You get the final choice. And it sounds like you've got a good head on your shoulders. So we're pretty sure that you're going to make a smart decision, but let us know how it goes and let us know what you end up doing, because we're excited to see what happens
totally.
In your life and in your wealth building process. Starting young is awesome. All right, Matt, we've got more listener questions to get to, including one about switching banks. How do you do it and where do you go? We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we're back from the break. We've got listener questions here still lined up for you. We're going to take a question about target date funds, but first let's hear from a listener who is asking about switching banks.
Hey, Matt and Joel, this is Tasha from Spokane, Washington. For starters, thank you so much for this show. I've been listening for about 3 years, and it has helped me budget and pay off more than $30,000 in consumer debt and even pay off my car loan early. Also, shout out to our Facebook community because you guys are always on it in there too. Anyway, on to my question at hand. So I am looking to switch from a big bank to a local credit union. I've been with my bank for about 10 years. I'm from a small town in eastern Montana where there wasn't, you know, much of a choice, but it's not serving me like it used to, and I want to make the switch. I'm wondering if you guys have like a step-by-step checklist maybe to help me get everything in order to switch all my stuff on over. Thank you. Bye.
Matt, first I got to say, yes, Tasha paid off debt and the car loan. Tasha, we love it. Thank you for sharing that, those wins. And yes, I love what she said also about the Facebook community. It is a bunch of awesome folks helping each other out on the reg. If you are listening and you're looking for online encouragement, we would suggest that. And you're also, you know, a member of Facebook, we would say, go in there, type how to money in the search bar, find our group and join it, because there are a lot of good conversations happening in there, a lot of good question answering. And yeah, you can take advantage, use the hive mind, the how to money listenership as a whole, to your benefit.
I would even say that it's worth joining Facebook just to join our group.
Yes, but then, like, just side note, I have that newsfeed eradicator, so I don't even have to see anybody else's postings. I can go straight to the group and only see that stuff. If that's what you're concerned about, getting addicted to scrolling Facebook all day, that's a good plug-in.
There you go. Well, Tasha, let's talk about finding the right bank, because it makes a huge difference, and, you know, leaving one of those big banks is something that we highly recommend, because the fees are typically outrageous. The customer service is subpar, and that's actually putting it nicely. Because doing business with a bank that actually wants your business and treats you well is something that we think everyone should prioritize. And yes, we actually do have a guide that we just recently published up on the site about switching banks. In that article, we talk about how to make the switch, and we highlight some of our favorite banks that we think are worth considering. But we'll also, of course, get to some of your questions here during this episode.
Yes, and I would say, you know, Tasha, you specifically mentioned moving your money over to a credit union, and that might be a great option, but we would say make sure that the credit union that you're joining has the perks that you like. We did a whole episode on credit unions a while back, Matt. We think they're great, but it's often mm-hmm. best to have a relationship, we would say, with an online bank and with a credit union. And that's because some of the online banks are doing the best work when it comes to providing the features that most folks actually want. So like Ally, Marcus, Discover, and One, which is a new player with cool features. They all have, we would say, better user interfaces, mm-hmm, better totally. Options for online banking. Some of them are paying much higher rates of interest than most of the big banks, of course, and then a lot of credit unions. And so, yeah, with a solid online bank, it's going to be easier to do something as simple as pulling up your monthly statements. I don't know why. Like, I love my credit union. Pulling up a monthly statement on that website is makes me want to, like, punch myself in the face.
Like, it sounds silly to say that this is something that, oh, online banks offer this, but literally it's because a lot of local credit unions have not prioritized this, and trying to pull up some documents for a refinance that I did last year was the most painful thing ever.
Yeah, you're like, so trying to, like, avoid jabbing yourself in the eye with a pen.
Yeah, it's like pulling teeth.
Yeah. So, yeah, we would say credit unions are typically best when it comes to borrowing, and they often have better rates if you're looking to get a loan. But when it comes to just traditional savings and checking, the online banks often have the best products.
That's right. And you can get those better rates with a local credit union, oftentimes because they are member-owned. So when you deposit money with a credit union, you become a member. And since it's member-owned, the credit union isn't looking to milk every single dollar that it can, as they are not-for-profit organizations. But since credit unions aren't charging as much interest, they are not in the business of feeing you to death. That also means that they're paying a lower rate of interest on the money that you do have with them. But that being said, you never know, because we talked about Kasasa a while back, and if your credit union participates in that program, they might pay you something close to like the 3% range on your savings if you jump through a few hoops, which usually means, you know, using your debit card 10 or 12 times a month, or direct depositing your paycheck into that credit union account. And so this is a way that you might be able to get the best of both worlds. So it's worth looking around. It's worth asking about, because if you're able to, you know, knock out two birds with one stone, that's definitely going to be the easiest way to go.
Yeah, ultimately, it's not that big of a deal for you to switch either. So we would say drop the gross bank that you're with and go with a local credit union or a medium-sized online bank, depending on your needs and what the offerings are from each of those institutions. I think, Matt, sometimes people build it up in their mind. They're like, switching banks, oh, this is going to be horrible. It's going to take me forever. And I think that's what prevents people from taking action. It's like this inertia bias. And
yeah,
we're like, we're just going to stay with the default thing because we know what it is. And we know that this other product might be better, but it's probably not worth the time to switch. Well, we would disagree. We think it is worth the time to switch. And we would say it doesn't take all that long to set up a new account either. But you need to make sure that once your new account is open, that you deposit funds, and then you switch any automatic payments and deposits to that new bank or credit union over the course of the next 30 to 60 days. You're going to want to make sure that like all of those ties, all of those recurring transactions have moved over to this new institution where you're planning to do most of your banking. And so, yeah, once all the ties to that old account have been severed, you're good to close the old account. But yeah, you want to make sure you do it in a methodical way, have both of those accounts open for a period of time while you're making the switch, and then just make for darn sure that you've got everything routed, all those automatic things routed over to the new institution where you're going to be doing most of your business.
That's right. So Tasha, best of luck to you. And regardless, we are sure that you're going to be much happier with your new bank. Joel, let's get to our next question, where a listener is asking about a special technique that he can employ when it comes to target date funds.
Hey, Matt and Joel. This is Randy calling from Pennsylvania. I am a government employee contributing to my 457B right now, and I'm eligible to retire with a full pension in 2 years. I currently have all of the money in the 2025 target fund, but my plan's representative said that I should move 25% into 2030, 25% into 2035, and 25% into 2040, and keep 25% into the 2025 fund when I recently participated in their retirement readiness review. He says, since I'll be withdrawing the money slowly at 3 or 4% per year for the next 25 to 33 years, that I should spread out the investment so they keep working for me. Right now, I have everything in the 2025 fund, which is currently 53% bonds and 47% stock. And I thought the point of the target funds was to put them in the year closest to retirement, which 2025 would be closest to my retirement at the end of 2023. And I thought you just put them in that target fund and kind of set it and forget it. And the closer you get to retirement, the less risk you would have. But I kind of see his point, too, that if I'm not withdrawing the money as fast, then I should allow some of it to continue working for me. But of course, that would also mean more risk. So I was just wondering what you thought of that. And I will look forward to your answer. So thank you, guys, and keep up the great show.
Randy, thanks for your question. And Matt, can I first just say, pensions are awesome.
Yeah.
And I kind of hate that they're a relic of the past.
Yeah, it's too bad.
That most people don't have a pension offered to them, because it is so helpful from a retirement planning perspective. Like, for instance, Randy, it just it makes these decisions so much less onerous when you know that a huge portion of the income you're going to need in retirement is covered by pension and Social Security. And so, yeah, the most of us, like we have to a bigger burden to sock more away for our future selves. And that's a big reason, Matt, why you and I, we're sitting here. We want to encourage people to save more because, yeah,
we've got to be more proactive
exactly.
than generations in the past had to.
Exactly. Yeah. But because Randy's got one, it's going to be a big help in this scenario.
That's right. And so essentially, Randy, what your financial advisor or the whoever you met with, what they're advising you to do is essentially called laddering. We've talked about this before when it comes to CDs, but this is a strategy that made sense before CDs basically became like giant nothing burgers in regards to how much interest you can earn. Like right now, CD rates are so low that it's hard to make much of a case for them at all. But I get what your advisor is getting at in regards to laddering your target date fund exposure, because I think the major reason that they're suggesting that you do this is because like one of the main criticisms of target date funds is the fact that they become too conservative once you reach retirement. That's what you described to us. And it's, you know, it's still important to have some exposure to the market, even in those retirement years. You still need to have some skin in the game so that money continues to work for you.
That's right. Yeah. But a target date fund in those retirement years, it does have equity exposure still, although
yes.
a smaller percentage of your portfolio, right? So basically that means that massive bouts of volatility in the market aren't going to have like this significant impact on your portfolio balance. When we see a huge stock market drawdown, well, those bonds are going to help you weather the storm and experience less of those negative consequences. But the thing is, like I said, you're still going to have some stocks in your target date fund, likely close to 50% of that, like you mentioned. So the traditional answer, Randy, would be exactly what you said. Set it and forget it. Take the simple answer. And I would say, I think that does make sense for most folks. But part of the answer comes down to your specific goals. Other than retiring in a couple of years at the end of, let's say, 2023, are you going to be happy with the nest egg that you've been able to stash away? If so, and you don't want to think about it anymore, then leave things like they are, all in that 2025 fund. But maybe on the other hand, are you hoping to see bigger gains, like larger amounts of growth, and you can afford to take that risk? Well, if that's the case, then taking a slightly more involved approach by laddering that target date fund, it does allow you the ability to continue to take a little more risk in that hope for greater financial rewards.
Yeah, honestly, the way I think about target date funds, like it makes me think of like an automatic transmission on a car, Joel, or like a stick shift. I see target date funds as the automatic transmission, whereas buying single stocks, that's like driving a stick shift. And most folks, right, you know, these days, have never driven a stick shift. That's because automatics are great.
I miss my stick shift, by the way.
Do you? Well, maybe you should trade single stocks. kind of get a feel there for
no,
it.
No, I like stick shifts, but not trading single stocks.
So the reason I mention this, though, is because there are some cars that, even though it's an automatic, you can kind of switch it to sport mode. Or there's like even like kind of like
the paddle shifters.
There's like these fancier cars, like little sports cars, where they have paddle shifters built into it. And it's an automatic, but it does give you a little bit more control. That's sort of how I see laddering target date funds like this. They're still these automatic funds in the sense that you don't have to worry about it. But by laddering them like that, you get a little bit more control. And so if you wanted to lean into it a little bit more, it's a way for you to be more involved in that process, Randy. And it's also important to consider what kind of flexibility that you'll have once you enter your retirement years, right? And so if the market tanks right after you retire, it's important to not be completely dependent on those funds. It would be great if you could significantly cut expenses, or better yet, if you could supplement your income. And as luck would have it, you do actually have a pension to cover a big chunk of your living expenses. And so you might be willing to take on some added risk by increasing your stock exposure. So it's important to keep in mind that this is a personal decision based on your timeline, your goals, and your comfort level, specifically with stock market gyrations. But if your goal is to, you know, like eke out a slightly higher return and you don't mind a ride with more ups and downs, then more stocks is probably going to be a good idea for you. But if you're the type of dude who is monitoring the market and would be more emotionally affected by what's happening on a weekly or monthly basis, or if you just don't want to have to think about it, I would just stick with the single target date fund and not worry about it at all.
Yeah, the mental game is such a huge part of even just a decision like this. But like you said, Matt, I mean, that pension just offers such a great backstop that really either decision, I feel like we're talking about minor tweaks and we're not talking about major overhauls. And so either decision Randy makes, he's going to be fine. And he just has to be willing to be flexible and know like that. Don't let this decision overcome you from like an emotional perspective when it comes to your investments.
Totally.
All right, Matt, we got a couple more questions to get to, including one about paying off a mortgage. Does it make sense? Well, we'll get to that and more right after this break.
right, we are back, and we've got a couple more listener questions. We're going to hear from somebody who wants to know what benefits she's going to miss out on by joining the ranks of the self-employed.
Hey, Matt and Joel, my name is Brittany. I'm from New York, and I'm a huge fan of your podcast. I'm about to turn 24, and I'm currently still living at home with my dad. I'm a musician and writer, so I work multiple part-time and gig-based jobs to allow for flexibility in my schedule for gigs and to allow time to work on creative projects. I'm hoping to move out within the year with my boyfriend, who is pretty much in the same boat as I am. So my question is a bit of a two-parter having to do with health insurance and saving for retirement. I'm lucky enough to be on my dad's health insurance plan until I turn 26, but if I continue to work part-time jobs and be self-employed, as you know, there's no benefits. Are there any affordable options for healthcare for someone who makes about $40,000 to $45,000 a year? My second question is, in the absence of a 401k, for the time being, is it sufficient to keep investing in my Roth and traditional IRAs? Lastly, as two people who are currently self-employed, are there any costs I'm forgetting about before I take the plunge into this kind of lifestyle? Thank you so much for everything you do. I absolutely love your podcast, so keep up the good work.
Brittany, thank you for the kind words. We appreciate you listening to the show. And again, like talking about Arjun starting in his teenage years. I mean, Brittany starting at age 24 or even earlier, she's been listening for a while. She said, like, there's just so many years for her to use that knowledge to build wealth. And that's awesome. So yeah, let's talk about healthcare for a second. Brittany, let's start there. Being on your parents' health insurance plan until age 26 is a nice perk that wasn't a reality until Obamacare came along. And so for a lot of young adults, it allows you a lot more flexibility when it comes to your healthcare if your parents have a good healthcare plan that you can still squeeze into. And so, yeah, the crazy thing is that you can still keep that benefit even if you move out, even if you're gainfully employed somewhere else. And this is the kicker, even if you get married, you can you can stay on that healthcare plan. And so,
You don't have to be a dependent on your parents' taxes in order to join that plan.
That's right. And it might be worth having a discussion with your dad, though, to see if maybe you can reimburse him for some of the extra premium costs that he's taking
take
on.
Take him out for drinks or a meal, maybe.
Yeah, but, you know, especially if you're moving out, it's one of those times where you can say, hey, listen, Dad, I know that this costs you money and I should be getting my own healthcare plan, but can I pay for my portion, or can I reimburse you for some of that? And you know, he might say, no, it's fine, I don't mind doing this, but he might at least appreciate the gesture.
That's right. But when the time comes for you to leave your parents' plan, it's probably going to be worth shopping the government marketplace because of the increased subsidies that have been added via legislation during COVID. And so you can go to healthcare.gov and it'll send you over to the state of New York's website in order for you to shop for a plan. And you might find that these subsidies make healthcare really affordable for someone who is in your income range. But the thing is, you're not going to know just how affordable it's going to be until you actually run the numbers. So just get in there, start plugging in some numbers, start getting some quotes, and you will quickly be able to see what that's going to cost you.
Yeah, and as you're looking into reasonably cost healthcare plans, one of the things that a lot of people have found, as you know, as their income grows, the healthcare marketplace becomes prohibitively expensive. It's just really difficult to afford the premiums, much less the out-of-pocket costs that come with healthcare plans on the exchange if you make a decent income. And so people have been turning towards health sharing companies, and they can be a good alternative for low-cost healthcare for certain people, but it's really important to know what you're signing up for when you're signing up for one of these plans. It's not actually insurance, although these plans function a lot like insurance.
Right.
And so for folks with low to moderate income levels, healthcare.gov is the best place, especially right now, for a lot of folks to turn. But those health sharing companies are worth looking into for a lot of people if you run the numbers and it's like, oh man, I can't afford that. But yeah, Matt, we have an article up on the website about MediShare. You've been a member there for a lot of years. I recently joined up, and that's a good place for a lot of folks to turn if you fit the requirements.
Totally. And Brittany, also, when it comes to your investing question, the answer is yes, keep investing. You're asking if it's going to be enough for you to invest within just the IRA. Like we mentioned with Arjun, hopefully you heard us answer his question earlier. You can do a lot of retirement damage by maxing out just your IRA
every
single year.
Become a millionaire, even if you never invest beyond just the Roth IRA and max that junker out.
That is completely true. Yeah. But at your income level, though, don't even think about putting money into a traditional IRA, because the tax break, it's going to be so minuscule. And with your creative pursuits, it sounds like your income should only continue to rise from what you're making currently. And the same is also going to be true of tax rates. We're only going to see those go up. And so pay that little bit of tax now and get the dollars that you invest in that tax-sheltered Roth IRA. Just be sure to max that out at $6,000 each year. That's a big chunk of money. And so if you want to kind of break that into smaller pieces, you're looking at $115 a week. And even still, I don't want it to sound like we're downplaying how much money that is, because $115 every single week, that is a lot of money. But if you are able to do that every single week, that will be something that you are glad that you did years from now.
Yes. And at the very end of Brittany's question, she asked about self-employed costs. Like, what else is she taking on that she hasn't thought about? And that's a good question. We would say you definitely want to think about vision and dental coverage, but here's the deal, because
sure,
those don't come along with the healthcare coverage on your, you know, on the healthcare exchange that you're getting. You have to buy a separate plan for those things. But the thing is, we would say self-insure, have more cash in the bank. Matt, you recently got your eyes checked out. It was what, $80, $85,
like $70?
Okay,
it's like
so
70,
it's cheap.
$75,
and then you got your Zenni glasses,
really affordable,
for $50, and you got three pairs or something like that. I mean,
yeah, it's $50 with the special coating.
Okay, yeah. So it's really, really cheap. To
these are water resistant.
They're fancy.
So, all plastics water resistant, right?
Yeah. So it's just so inexpensive to do those things on your own. You don't need coverage for those things.
That's right.
Same with a dental plan. Like, go, you know, find a dentist that will, for a cash price, you know, do your dental cleaning once or twice a year.
And just be sure to floss every day.
Exactly. Take care of your teeth.
Flossing is highly underrated.
And, you know, I guess one other maybe self-employed benefit that you're not going to have access to, life insurance, but that's not really applicable because it sounds like,
yep,
Brittany doesn't have anyone who depends on her income.
Too young to consider that.
Yeah. And, you know, no snacks at the workplace office. No water cooler.
Although she's still, for the moment being, you know, still living at home with dad, and so maybe sneak a couple of those granola bars. It might feel like you're taking advantage of the Nature Valley bar that you might pick up if you were employed somewhere. But Brittany, we hope that points you in the right direction, and it sounds like you are thinking about the right things ahead of time, which we are glad to hear. All right, Joel, let's get to our next question. This is from a listener who is further along in his financial journey, and he wants to know if it makes sense to pay off a mortgage, and which one should he pay off first?
Hi, Joel and Matt. This is Pat in Bend, Oregon. I love listening to your show while running my dog. I had a quick question about paying off my primary residence versus paying off a rental property. My wife and I both fully fund our retirement accounts, including maxing out my 401k and having Roth IRAs for both of us. We owe about $90,000 left on our primary residence and about $128,000 on a rental property. Wanted to get your opinion, which was better, to pay off the primary residence or pay off the rental property? The interest rate on the primary residence is slightly better than the rental property. Thanks.
All right, Pat, first I got to say, I like that you're able to multitask in that way, running with your dog while listening to How to Money is impressive.
If it was you, well, you've got cats now, but you don't have to walk cats, do you?
No, my neighbor actually has a leash for their cat, and they do sometimes walk their cat. And
it's like, oh, we got this leash for the cat, and we just hang it on the peg on the wall because that's all it does.
Yes, I'm not planning to become that kind of cat person personally. But
yeah,
Pat, congrats on crushing it with your retirement account contributions as well. Most of the time when people ask this question, when people want to pay off their mortgage early, we usually say it's a fantastic goal, but we prefer for you to consider other options first. We'd say, like, contributing more to retirement accounts that will, at least by historical standards, provide a nicer return for you over the years. There's this opportunity cost that you incur,
yep,
when it comes to paying off a mortgage that's, you know, especially in the 3% range, which hopefully yours is, Pat. Hopefully you've refinanced at some point and your mortgage is now at one of these rock bottom rates that we've been seeing over the past year and a half, because you're going to miss out on the growth of that money that you'd get from sticking more of those funds in the market. That's our traditional answer, but yeah, we think there's a little more nuance required when it comes to your question.
Yeah, and it makes sense too that the interest rate on your primary home, it's a little bit better than the one on your rental property. There's usually a half a point difference. But Pat, as far as, you know, when it makes sense to pay off the mortgage on that property, if you're getting close to retiring and, you know, you're looking to really stabilize and reduce the amount of risk that you're exposed to, then that makes sense. Or maybe, you know, if you're years from retirement, but you just simply want to have that peace of mind that comes from reducing your overall debt load, knowing that it probably isn't the most fully optimized route to take. And that last point is a big one, because it's okay to not be fully optimized, but you want to make that decision knowing the trade-offs, and for you, if being debt-free, if that's the main goal and you're okay not optimizing 100%, then we would recommend for you to go ahead and pay off that mortgage.
Yeah, a prior guest we had on the show, Andy Hill, he podcasts over at Marriage, Kids, and Money, and he has highlighted why he paid off his mortgage in like 4 years. And he's a young fella too. And so that's something that Matt and I don't want to say we disagree with him on it, but that's just not the route we took. And I understand completely why he did what he did.
Totally.
But there's like, what, different strokes for different folks maybe?
That's right.
And so yeah, paying off a mortgage is something that we don't prioritize until you're in what we call money gear number 7. And that's because the mortgage on your properties, they're at really low interest rates. And it's also giving you a tax write-off. So instead, we would say, can you use the money you would have taken to pay the mortgage to increase cash flow? Maybe by buying another rental property, if that's something you'd want to do, or to passively invest in the market inside of a brokerage account, since you're already maxing out your retirement accounts. So yeah, Pat, I'd encourage you to read through our money gears again. We'll link to them in the show notes. It's worth making sure that you've gone through all of these other steps first before prioritizing, yeah, that mortgage payoff.
But assuming that you're going to pay off one of those mortgages no matter what, which one you pay off first depends on a few things, specifically though, taxes. And this is one of those areas where we obviously don't know all of your details, so we would recommend that you reach out to a tax professional on this topic. But the answer likely depends on whether or not you take the standard deduction, because if you're like around 90% of Americans and you take the standard deduction, then you'll likely want to pay off your primary residence, since you're not getting a specific tax deduction for the interest that you're paying there. However, if you itemize your deductions and you're already, you're clawing back every penny that you can from the IRS, then we would recommend paying off the rental mortgage, since it sounds like that you're paying a slightly higher rate on that property.
Yes, yes, agreed. And, you know, Pat, just to sum it up, we would say having no debt is definitely the most secure financial position that you can be in. We don't think having debt is the best thing ever, but we're also not haters when it comes to low interest debt on your house. We don't promote endless borrowing to buy a dream home that's beyond your means. And we want people to bring more money to the table when they purchase a home in the first place.
Absolutely.
We don't want people to get enamored with leverage, and we don't want to praise it.
Look at all the stuff I can buy.
Yeah. If I only put,
as long as I am paying interest on it.
If I only put 3% down on my home, then you know that's just puts you in a financially insecure place. But that's not where you're at. That's not the position you're in, Pat. And so we would say, yeah, if you're comfortable with how much you have invested for your future, and you also have this strong desire to be debt-free, go ahead and pay off one of those mortgages. And yeah, like Matt said, the tax angle is probably what it's going to come down to for which one you decide to tackle first.
That's right. Joel, let's go ahead and get back to our beer. This episode, you and I enjoyed a beer called Really Green Street. This is a double IPA by Trillium and Other Half. What were your thoughts on this one?
I'll tell you this. I'm going to start praying tonight for a lifetime supply of this beer, like in our beer fridge, because
just Trillium in general.
Yeah. Just
everything we've had by them over the past several episodes has been amazing.
Yeah, it really has been. So big thanks to Allie for sending these beers our way. It's been a treat for sure. I would say drinking this one is like a fluffy, hot flavored cloud. That's the best way I can describe it, because it's like it soaked my tongue with just like hop goodness. It was super concentrated, but it wasn't overly dense. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, man, like that's just kind of what I'm used to from these two breweries. And so it's for so them good. To team up and make this beer, just like, it makes me happy.
So you said hop goodness, which makes me think of like when you eat a really good, like a real, really healthy salad, like kale and other greens, which actually I had a little bit of today for lunch. Maybe that's why this is on my mind. But oftentimes it has like a bitterness to it, because these greens, you know, there's so much goodness packed into this food that you're eating that has got to be a little bit bitter, because there's a lot of vitamins and stuff like that going on in there. That's what I feel like with this specific beer, that they have such a large quantity of hops in this that it almost... it slightly eclipses some of this, the sweeter notes, and it's kind of bordering on that bitter edge, hop territory.
But that good kind of bitter, right?
Yeah, like, yes. No. Yeah.
There's a way in which beers can be.
I thoroughly enjoyed my salad earlier today.
Yeah.
At lunch, and I am thoroughly enjoying this beer.
It's the good kind of bitter combined with that like those juice tones.
It's like when you're working out. It's like, oh, it's the good hurt. This is the good bitter, not like bitter beer face. You know, the old commercials, was it like Heineken or something like that?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like a, like a decade ago. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about like that good bitter.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. So thanks again, Allie. Seriously, it was
these are great
beers, and this one was excellent in its own right. So, all right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. For listeners who want to submit a question for a future Ask HTM episode, well, we would love to hear it. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple directions for recording a voice memo, sending it our way via email, and hopefully we can take it on the show in a couple weeks.
That's right. So that's going to be it for this episode. Joel, until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.